Friedrich, what's he doing?
Beats me, Franz, but rumor is he stopped hearing long ago.
Guys, Caroline looks like she's gonna say something. Maestro Beethoven, the piece has finished. Turn around, Ludwig. See? See how they still adore you? 12 years, Ludwig. 12 years. Vienna never forgot you.
By 1824, Beethoven was internationally famous. Yet he'd spent more than a decade as a recluse from public life. Since the completion of his 8th symphony in 1812, his family woes were reaching an all-time crisis point. Beethoven's nephew and ward, Karl, had attempted suicide in order to free himself from the tyrannical composer's tough love. Beethoven's love life was even more dire. He was too much of a commoner for his single female friends, and those who weren't aristocrats were already hitched. But worst of all his fears was his increasing deafness. It put a stop to his piano performances. It stalled his ability to compose. Living in squalor, drinking a bottle of wine a day, and suffering from rheumatism and jaundice, he needed the money more than ever. A commission came in 1817 from the Philharmonic Society of London for a new symphony, and it was no easy rite. Beethoven, now middle-aged, bedraggled, and angry with the world, only completed the piece in 1824. But the result was spellbinding. It's as though his affliction so much liberated him from the realm of actual sound that he was now able to hear on a level that others couldn't even begin to imagine. Unlike Mozart, he didn't need to satisfy the whims of some paying master. Nor was this piece in the service of God. Instead, it was the ultimate in self-expression. Hard-headed, independent Beethoven was now writing for himself. And what better way for the deaf composer to begin his symphony with the idea of sound emerging from silence? Violins cascade over the top of deep rumbling strings. They play perfect fifths, that most ancient and elemental of intervals. Rhythm, melody, and harmony are all ambiguous, almost sounding as if the orchestra is tuning up. It's the building blocks of sound, musical plasma emerging out of a black hole of silence. Never before had a symphony started with just pure atmosphere. Mozart just got right down to business, firmly establishing our key and time signature. But even when we get our big bang in a thunderous key of D minor, the music's always restless. For we can at any time slip from minor to major, from despair to joy. For this symphony is a journey of darkness to light and of chaos to order. It lays out the path from silence to sound and eventually to a music that gloriously transcends the deaf composer's struggle to communicate. Just when we think we've settled on a defiant and heroic climax, the music sinks to a funeral march. The basses creep upwards and downwards to restore the mystery of the symphony's opening. In the second movement, Beethoven throws out the rulebook. Normally, second movements are slow, whereas third movements are dancey scherzos. But Beethoven takes us straight to a scherzo with skipping strings playing a fiery dance. Even more revolutionary is his use of the stomping, out-of-phase timpani. He deploys these tuned drums not as subsidiary instruments providing rhythmic backbone to the music, but as melodic instruments in their own right. It's such an iconic statement of nervous tension that Dvorak ripped it off for the scherzo movement of his own Ninth Symphony. Oboes and clarinets usher in a contrasting section called a trio. It's a folky tune full of Slavic cheer. but the pounding timpani drives us back into the scherzo, propelling us forward to an optimistic D major ending. But this life-affirming, earthy cheer isn't to last, for the third movement is an aching, dreamlike vision of longed-for peace and happiness. Two lyrical themes intertwine in a set of increasingly complex variations. Unbearably moving, always yearning, the hymn-like quality is a precursor of what's to come. That world of longed-for joy is just moments over the horizon. A jubilant fanfare promises this victory in the midst of our dream, but joy doesn't come easily, and freedom must be earned. So a massive, dissonant outburst of wind and brass plunges us back into dark chaos. It's what Wagner called the Schreckens fanfare, the fanfare of terror. Now remember that this symphony is about that search for light in darkness, for order in chaos, and for music in sound. Beethoven now surveys the ground we've covered. Does the music of the last three movements help us on our journey? We hear a fragment of the first movement, but cellos and basses reject it. Too gloomy, too joyless. Now a fragment of the second movement, though this is again rejected by cellos and basses. Too turbulent, too restless. Third movement doesn't fare much better, for freedom and joy must be grounded in reality, not dreams. What's needed is an altogether new theme, which we now hear on cellos and basses. It's in a joyous D major and almost sounds like the strings are speaking, as if in an operatic recitative. As the theme is restated and developed, we soon realise the timelessness of this uplifting hymn. It's a mere five notes, the perfect blend of imposing and accessible, noble and plain. You'd never know that Beethoven, in fact, laboured painstakingly over it, 200 attempts to perfect its simplicity. Just when we reach a climax, we're interrupted mid-sentence with that returning Schreckens fanfare, the voice of doubt reasserting itself. What's gone wrong? Well, what is joy without people to experience it? And in an electrifying moment of surprise, Beethoven gives us the sound of the human voice, its first appearance in a symphony. O friends, not these sounds, shouts a baritone. Let us sing more cheerful songs, full of joy. Now for the symphony's crowning glory, the Ode to Joy, written in 1785 by famous German writer Friedrich Schiller. The poem extolled the virtues of harmony and justice for all mankind. It was a defiant statement of optimism and idealism, written at a time when tyrants were asserting their oppressive rules across Europe, not least in revolutionary France. But why did Beethoven incorporate Schiller's ode 40 years after it was written? Well, by the 1820s, the Napoleonic dream had proven disappointing. Europe had returned to reactionary politics, and the repercussions were being felt in Beethoven's Austria, now ruled by ruthless conservatives ready to crack down on artistic freedom. What better time to revive old revolutionary ideals, to establish a new utopia founded on liberal principles of social change and political reform? In his celebration of the democratic longings of the populace, Beethoven even pokes fun at the old image of the great Napoleonic commander. The tenor sings to the backing of a Turkish march like a drunken soldier in praise of conquering heroes, but he's soon buried by the full might of the choir, who add to the movement's jumble of ideas, a mixture of symphony, cantata, opera, theme and variations, political speech, philosophical rant, and celebratory jam, all united under one roof, mightily reconciled by a community of voices. They invoke a rapturous vision of God, who sits in the vast cosmos, while humankind dwells like a speck under the canopy of stars, small and futile, yet infinitely powerful when clubbed together in universal fraternity. The bond between brothers will always be stronger than the orders of the tyrant. As the choir sing blocked major chords, we realise we've reached our goal. Order in chaos, light in darkness, music in silence. The struggle to communicate is no longer, and Beethoven has found a universal language to express joy's triumphs over despair and division. This is why the Ode to Joy melody is used in the international community to symbolise nations coming together in peace and harmony. Très woke. It's the official anthem of the European Union. It's heard as often at Olympic ceremonies as at New Year celebrations. One of the most famous versions is a mega concert played next to the Berlin Wall with musicians from France, Britain, Russia and America. It was to mark the reunification of Germany and reconciliation of past foes. And just when we think Beethoven has thrown every idea into this crazy mixture, he gives us a great double fugue. Two themes intertwined in magnificent counterpoint, yet always coherently merged. Individual voices shout out from the multitudes, "Joy, joy!" The orchestra races euphorically at a new tempo with yet another theme towards a triumphant ending. Beethoven completed the symphony in 1824, but he was pessimistic about premiering it in his hometown of Vienna. Musical tastes in the city were changing, and interest was now focused on Italian composers like Rossini. It took 30 members of the Viennese musical establishment to petition the reclusive German to persuade him that he still mattered in the city after his decade of retirement from public life. Beethoven was persuaded, but by the time the theatre was selected, the musicians hired and the date set, only 3 days remained to rehearse this new and deeply challenging music. The concert was a tentative sight reading of messy handwritten scores. Even worse for Beethoven, the expense of the production, with the largest orchestra ever assembled, meant that profits were minimal. The curmudgeonly composer stormed out of the post-performance dinner after accusing his faithful secretary of cheating him and mismanaging the whole event. A follow-up performance of the symphony fared even worse. No one turned up, and it was an even greater financial failure. Sadly, that one was Beethoven's final concert before his death. But the Ninth Symphony was his parting gift to the world, probably the most influential symphony ever written. It liberated the formal restraint and rigid structure of the classical symphony. It looked to a new romantic model that expanded the range of musical expression further than ever before. This model of subjective expression, pure, unfettered emotion, provided a wellspring of endless possibility for later composers. Schubert and Brahms both stole the Ode to Joy theme for their own symphonies. Liszt's symphonic poems, Bruckner's rumbling string openings, and Mahler's sprawling symphonies all owe a debt to Beethoven's masterpiece. Yet Wagner was its staunchest advocate, proposing that it paved the way for the music of the future. The manner in which Beethoven's symphony fused words and music in a universal drama greatly inspired Wagner's vision for his own operas. In fact, so daunting was the legacy of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony that many later composers struggled with the question of how to ever write a Tenth Symphony. It's a phenomenon called the Curse of the Ninth, a spooky coincidence that so many composers have died after completing their Ninth Symphonies. But for Beethoven, his final symphony was a work of intense paradoxes. Despite the symphony's message of brotherhood, he had few friends. Despite its message of joy, he was a frail, unhappy man in constant physical and emotional pain. Despite its celebration of God's fatherly goodness, he was not religious. And despite its exquisite music, he was a man for whom sound no longer existed. For when Beethoven conducted from the podium at the premiere, The truth is that the musicians had been told to ignore him. Rather, they were to watch the discreet, reliable beat of the real conductor, Michael Umlauf. Beethoven's hearing was so compromised that he didn't even notice when the orchestra had finished playing. So deeply immersed in a world of his own, he was still conducting when the orchestra were giving their massive ovation. When the contralto soloist Caroline Unger turned him round to face the audience, it was as though Beethoven had finally discovered that connection so rarely found in his personal life. In that single moment, it was as though he was liberated from his affliction, embraced by the multitudes after a decade of reclusion. It was as though the message of the symphony, the power of humankind to unite in joy once freed from the shackles of tyranny, had come true. Well, that's it, folks. Follow our channel, support us on Patreon, listen to the piece in full, and most importantly, enjoy classical music.